Did you work in movies, Elmer?
I only was in one. I was in one with Nate Cudby. I just wanted for the credits. I went out to Hollywood and stayed a month learning how to do it, but it was a little bit too flaky for me, and it wasn't even snowing out there. And I said, I don't think I want no part of this.
What was it like for you to work with Marty Robbins and Statler Brothers, Patsy Cline? Tell me about some of the entertainers that you worked with back in the days of real country music.
Back in the day, Patsy Cline and I worked together. Charlie Rich, which he and I, well, I was on the board of directors of Rope in Nashville, which I can't go there anymore. I'm not on it anymore. But anyway, Patsy Cline was on Crutches, the first time I ever worked with her. They needed the money. She got $150, and I got $50. And she never made any money as long as she was alive. I'm talking about maybe $450, $500 a night. But Charlie Dick got rich after she died.
Really?
Marty Robbins, one of the great entertainers and just a simple guy. He called me one day, him and Bobby Sykes. I used to print bikinis for all the entertainers. Just, they'd give them away and or sell them or whatever they did. And he said, meet me at the Hall of Fame. Me and Bobby Sykes said, meet Marty and me at the Hall of Fame Motor Inn. Said, he wants to talk to you. I said, okay. I met him over there, and he said, I want to. Said, I'm still in car racing. I said, I'll have to quit in the middle of the race and go. I worked the Opry, but said, I want you to make me some bikinis. Said, you have an art department. I said, yeah, I do. He said, make me something what you think. Called him back, and I said, what I've got for you, I put your face in a checkered flag and said, Marty Robbins rides again on a pair of bikinis. Well, he called me about, after I got the bikinis done, I ordered 12 dozen. Just give them away. Never sold him. He gave them away. And he said, look, said, my wife might call you. Said, I don't think she's got your phone number, but you tell her that you just made those bikinis just for fun. He didn't want her to find out about them bikinis because he'd give them away to everybody that wanted one.
I want to know about how do you pack a show using Elvis's name?
Well, I'll tell you what. Taylor Swift is the hottest thing in America. She sold out Staples Center out in Hollywood, out in Los Angeles, 5 times. And I don't know how she does it. I've been looking at her methods, and I don't know. I'm just not smart enough to figure that out. But Elvis Presley has to be he would be the hardest guy to follow. I've had to follow Jerry Lee one time because he did an encore. He said, go out there and do something for him. I said, are you kidding? We was working at college in Florida. I'll never forget it. He said, well, go out there and tell a joke or something, and I'm going to change shirts. I'm wringing wet. He said, I'm going to come back encore. He never had the whole, never in the history. And I'd worked with him encore before, and he wanted me to go out there and follow him. I had to do it because he was the boss. But it's not easy. I'll tell you what, the opening act, people think it's easy, but, I mean, following a big act is hard. In fact, Mac Vickery and I, we were probably the innovators in starting shows out of Nashville. Most entertainers that didn't do nothing but go into a microphone and look straight ahead. And we did shows, even in Texas, in ballrooms. But I bought a spotlight. See, them dancers didn't want to get in that spotlight. And we got out on the floor and had a wrong mic cord. We could work ballrooms in Texas. It wasn't that easy now. Don't misunderstand, because they want to dance. But we got by with doing shows in Texas. I guess the first ones that ever did it.
Well, now, Mac, he's in the Hillbilly Hall of Fame and the Alabama Music Hall of Fame.
Mac Vickery was from Alabama like I was.
Yeah.
He worked for Hank Jr. First. That's how we got together. We both from Alabama. And Hank Jr.'s mother, Audrey, Hank kept Mac to close the show. Well, Audrey didn't want that. Mac was just a little bit too good for Junior at that time, and she fired him. And we were sitting at the old country corner there in Nashville one day, and he said, what are you doing? I said, well, I'm working a lot of shows. I said, if you want to get a job with me, we'll team up and see if we can't be a Bob Hope and Bing Crosby or something, you know, do something. And he said, well, that sounds all right. So we went out and we started building. We was getting $450. I'm getting $450 without him, but I couldn't get the $450 with him. I'm sorry to say this, Mac just didn't have enough name credibility to draw people. And the Foot Fucker name brought even African-American people. And I asked them one time why they come. They said, we had to see the dude that carried that handle around. But anyway, I'll get back to Mac Vickery. Mac Vickery is probably the greatest entertainer that never made it that ever was in Nashville, Tennessee. We had two songs in Urban Cowboy, Rocking My Life Away and Honky Tonk Wine. We were partners on a lot of things. They used to call a name in on it. We split it down 50-50, everything. And we had a lot of hit. He had the biggest check we ever got was from a George Strait record called the Fireman. It was a big, big hit.
Yeah, I know the Fireman. So you were on that. You wrote that part of it.
Yes. Well, Mac, yeah. What I did mostly for Mac, I would drive the motorhome and figure out ways to promote. He would sit back. He'd lay down in the back of the motorhome and write songs. And we had a good team. I figured out how to make it work, and I critiqued the songs, and I could get them cut. And, you know, I'm not that he couldn't, but I knew everybody. It wouldn't matter. I could get in Buddy Tiller's office if he had the President of the United States in there. I'd come in, over, you know, not that big, but I'm talking about I could get in. Now I couldn't get in the back door over there, so I was a janitor, you know.
Now,
it's changed a lot.
Hollis, there's two mysteries I want to ask you about. Actually, there's three
right.
mysteries. And maybe you can tell me, and maybe you don't want to talk about it. But well, I'm going to ask you. Number one, all right, you mentioned Hank Williams Jr. That means that you met his mom, Miss Audra. Of course, his daddy, Hank Williams Sr.
Yeah.
Now,
I never met Hank Sr. Now, I've been to his house. In fact, Audra called me out there one time, said she had an all-girls band, and she said, can you book this band? I said, Audrey, I don't think I can get a lot of big money, but my agency, I say, I'll do some, because she had done a lot. We'd worked a lot with Hank Jr. She'd give us a lot of dates, and, you know, I'll try to return a favor. So I said, okay, I'll try it, Audrey. I said, I can't get you. She said, I don't need the money. I said, just whatever you can get. And some of the military bases, you're well known. I said, okay, Audrey. I booked her to NCO Club. I got her in that bus and the whole band, $650 is all I could get. They just wouldn't pay it. And she got drunk on the stage, and I like to ruin my career myself.
Oh, my gosh, really?
I loved Audrey. I loved her. I'll tell you what she do. We used to have an office over there by her in the same building. And I've seen her take songwriters off the street, you know, trying to make it, you know, and she'd listen to their songs. And she had time for people, and she got a bad rap about a lot of stuff, but I really admired the woman, and I think she was the force behind Hank Williams Sr. and Jr.
That's exactly what I was going to ask you. Was she the force behind both of them, and what type of a woman was she? Probably a businesswoman, too, am I correct?
Businesswoman. She wanted to be a singer, but she couldn't. I hate to say it, but she couldn't sing a lick. In fact, one night on a show, she was trying to sing their song, These Boots Are Made for Walking. You remember that song?
Yeah.
Nancy Sinatra had it out. And she had to start it three times. She couldn't get it. And Frank Jr. was all standing back there. And he said, oh, Ma, get off of the stage. Oh, my.
Elvis Presley, you know, you said you knew Colonel Tom Parker did. And, of course, you worked around Jerry Lee. So I'm assuming you probably met Elvis at one time or another.
Yeah. The thing, my buddy, Charlie Hodge, you can see him. He was the guy. We grew up together in Alabama. His grandfather had a farm next to my grandfather, and we used to play together, me and Charlie. And Charlie, of course, he worked for Elvis till he died. And he worked for the Foggy River Boys, and he was quite a talent. If you look at a gospel thing, he's a guy playing the piano where they're singing in the dressing room
mm-hmm.
or in Elvis's room. Have you ever seen that, any of that footage?
I think I have, yes. I've pulled
that's
it up Charlie on YouTube.
Hodge singing and playing, looking right at Elvis, looking up in his eyes, you know. And that's how I've got to meet. Of course, I could go to Graceland anytime, you know. But
right.
Elvis was a prisoner. He couldn't even go. In fact, Mac and him played football one night. He rented a stadium at like 12 at night or whatever time it was. And Mac and him, both of them was quarterbacks, you know.
Uh-huh.
And I stood up there and I said, Mac, make sure you let him win. Because Mac went out for the whatever the Michigan team was one time. He was going to be a professional football player, but he let Elvis win, which is that's fair.
I guess it's fair. We're talking with Hollis Champion, a.k.a. Elmer Fudpucker. He is a man that has been in all sides of the music industry.
I wanted to know about, didn't you use Elvis's name one time in the marquee to draw in a crowd?
This is embarrassing, but I promised the mayor I'd never tell the name of the town, and I do hold up to my promises. This guy, I was working this town, and they built a road around his motel, and he was dying, man. He said, I cannot make a living. He always let me stay in the motel free when it come to town and fed me good. He said, you're a promoter. He said, what would you do? I said, well, let me think about it. I don't really know what I'd do. I'd probably sell the place. He said, I can't sell it. Nobody wants it. I said, okay. About two or three days later, I called him back. I said, just for fun, put this on the marquee. Welcome, Elvis Presley. He had the office traffic jam, fights, motel was sold out, he ran out of food, police was there 24/7, and they finally caught on that Elvis wasn't going to be there. He called me and said, I'm in a lot of trouble. I said, we get charged here, very serious problem. I said, what can I do? I said, man, I didn't know it was going to cause that kind of trouble, but I said, I'll try to figure out a way to get out of it. So I called him back about 2 days later. I said, you tell him that Elvis wasn't coming, but he was welcome if he showed up.
What do you think is the worst time for Hollis Champion during the 50-plus years you've been in music where you just absolutely didn't know what to do, where to go, and got down on your knees and say, God, what can I do? Do you remember any of those times that were just down and out on Hollis?
Yeah, we was on a tour once with Guy Mitchell. And you remember Guy had Singing the Blues, a big hit. Marty Robbins had the song, but Guy Mitchell had the super hit. I was touring with him. Jim Ames, who managed him, he's the one that gives Charlie Pride. He's the one... Jack Johnson gets credit, but Jim Ames did it. Jim said, I want to put you with Guy Mitchell. Said, he's been out of the game for a while. I said, what an entertainer, tap dancer. He can sing. He's got hits. And said, work a tour with him. Well, we started out, and Guy couldn't keep him sober. He would drink shaving lotion, mix it with water, and drink it out of a little plastic thing you put ice in.
Whoa.
And I said, Guy, you got to stay sober. We can't charge these people, for these tickets if you can't do a show. I said, me and Mac ain't heavy enough to carry it. And we run out, and we left him at a church in Phoenix, Arizona, and had to sell the Nudist Colony album, getting back down to where the mob was in Hot Springs and go to work. They put us back. That's the lowest time I ever had. We'd go from service station and buy gas. I had a little record player, so happened. I don't know why I had it, but I'd play just the littlest album, let them hear it, and I'd sell it to them for $5.
Really?
And it was priced at $6.95. That was the lowest time in my career. I mean, I just went flat broke. I mean, really busted.
And that was probably Tulane Road all the way back from where you were, I would assume.
That's right. That's right. I was back in the old days, man, we finally got enough money to gather to get the gas to get to Hot Springs, and they give us a job, and that's where it all began to happen again. I'll always be in debt to Hot Springs, Arkansas.
Let's talk a little bluegrass. You mentioned the Stanley Brothers a while ago, and I know that you've worked in radio, Bell Monroe and the Bluegrass Boys. I've worked around all those people back in my younger days. Tell me about some of your bluegrass excursions.
Well, I was on a show with Bobby and Sonny Osborne. Remember, that's my favorite bluegrass group of all times. I mean, I like Bill, worked a lot some with him. And I used to have a radio show, and Bill was on the show quite a bit. See, I think bluegrass is one of the most underestimated sounds there are. They're the most loyal audience. I was going to book bluegrass at my place over here in Madison, but I had that heart attack and I decided not to bluegrass is the best buy in the business, and their fans are the most loyal. They're like gospel, they people. They really show up, and maybe not in numbers like, you know, like 10,000 or like that. But bluegrass has been the. If I had been a bluegrass promoter, in fact, Jimmy Newman tried to get me to. He said, "Man, I wish you'd be my manager." I said, "Jimmy, I got more than I can handle now." He was a Cajun. I'd have put him in college. If I'd have been a bluegrass promoter, I'd have been putting Bill Monroe and all them boys in colleges where you can get some money for your work. I really love bluegrass. I'm sort of like Vince Gill. I wanted to own my own house. That's what Vince Gill said. He liked to play bluegrass. You'd be surprised at the big names, not myself necessarily, but the big names that like bluegrass. I spent a lot of time with George Jones. I know a lot about him. And I know a lot about Farron Young. Me and him worked a lot of got together. Farron was sort of my hero. He taught me something, and I'm going to repeat it. When you're doing an interview, they tell you, I own a consulting company. They said, don't keep framing up other people's names because you want to get them back on your name again. I said, well, I've done had a lot of that, so I talk about everybody else now. I said, anyway, Aaron Young, we did a show in Texarkana, Texas, or Arkansas, whichever side the auditorium's on, I don't know which. And this guy said, you guys have got to come to my restaurant for supper, for food after your night show. I said, well, I'm on Farron's bus, whatever he wants to do. Farron said, yeah, we'll go eat. Went over there, and Farron said, on the way over there, Farron said, I'm going to teach you a lesson you never learned, putt-pucker. I said, what's that, Farron? Said, they only give you something when you when you can afford to buy it. Said, if you and me had been a couple of hobos needing a bite to eat, he wouldn't even let us have the garbage off of the back steps. I never forgot that. And I write. After that, I worked a show with Joan Amos down in Lauderdale, Fort Lauderdale, and this guy owned a Rolls Royce dealership, and I was selling albums. I'm really pitched. I don't care. If I was in Las Vegas, I'd do the same thing. I go out there and sell it myself, and now I got other people selling it too. But I never forgot that. This guy wanted to buy an album, and I sold it to him. The guy said, hey, you shouldn't have sold him that album. Could have given it to him. That's a Rolls Royce dealer. I said, that's the reason I sold it to him. He's a Rolls Royce dealer. I won't give one to somebody who can't afford to buy it.
Tell me about your radio career. We never really said too much about it. I want to know about Elmer Fudd-Pucker's radio career. Was you syndicated?
Syndicated and had a 57 market. But syndication started going out about the time I came in. Even the operator, they sort of quit syndicating. We had a good run, had some pretty good sponsors, but it started dying. People started wanting to give me, not give me the cars, but I had 50 auto rental. They were one of my sponsors, and had a budget motel. Had some pretty good sponsors, but they started wanting to give me rooms, and had Ramadi in at one time. But it got to where everybody wanted to trade. I said, I need a little cash, folks. I don't need no motels. I don't need no cars. I got all that. But radio was good to me. I have to say, man, I wish it had come back. I sure do.
What was the name of your show?
Nashville Nightline. We sort of copied it from, you know, Nightline. We called ours Nashville Nightline. And we had every big star you want to mention, just about any. In fact, one way we did it three nights a week. And we got paid for the location. They had to pay us, like, if we did the show live at your facilities, we got paid for it. But, I really enjoyed it. I met, one week I had Chet Atkins and, two different times, I had Chet Atkins and, what's the guy, I had Jerry Reed, two different guitar players on one week. And, you know, I just have one big star a night. The rest was unknowns. I'd play anybody's record if I could, if it was halfway decent. You can't get a record played today.
No.
Unless you've got a lot of... It's just hard to get a record played.
When you opened up for Patsy Cline, what was it like? How was Patsy as a person?
She was great to me. Her and Charlie... It's like I said, Charlie and I was on the board of directors and on rope in Nashville for a long time. And Charlie, of course, I won't get into their personal lives, but Patsy Cline was... probably one of the greatest acts. Every female I know wants to be Patsy Cline. I was with James Brown the night that Otis Redding's plane went down, and the MC announced it on the show. Now, James Brown would draw. I've never worked a show with him. Of course, the auditorium didn't seem about 7,500 or some over 2,500 small places. But the announcer announced that Otis Redding had just got killed. Poor James, come on. He never could get that audience back. You don't do that on a show. Mention that anything is down. Everything has to be up. But I get back to Patsy Cline. She was always good to me. She respected me. See, I only ask two things from people. I want respect and trust. You don't even have to like me.
That's good stuff.
But I'd rather you would like me. I'll do everything I can, and I'll give you free parking. Did you know, Jason knows this, I'll give you free parking at Walmart. I'll give you free parking at McDonald's, free. You can park free. I'll give you. It's after 12 o'clock at night, but I can get you free parking.
Jason, I'll be down to pick you up. We're going to head down to Branson.
I was in we started out traveling in a hearse. It's the truth. Mac Victor used to do a spook show. He was two guys. I never did do the spook show.
I'd
seen the spook show, and they traveled in a hearse. And after he quit doing it, both of them got loaded one morning before the spook show was in the afternoon. And the guys, they messed up and put on the wrong suits. They were supposed to be in Frankenstein suits and been in with what some of them other suits are supposed to have on. And the theater man paid them and said, "This is the sorriest spook show I've ever had in my theater." And let me tell you about me and Victor. We worked Hot Springs a lot during the race season, every year just about. But anyway, because that's where the money was, because them race horse people have money. But I said, Magma Fiction worked Las Vegas. I said, we need to take some tap dance lessons. I said, we can learn just enough to do a little, like Bing Crosby and, Fred Astaire, and just get a little soft shoe, not get in no complicated stuff. So we took tap dance lessons. Two hillbilly rednecks, cotton pickers out of Alabama, taking tap dance lessons. We got to Vegas, and the first opening night, we dropped our hats and our canes, we was doing this cross thing. You cross your legs, and we went the wrong way, and we run into each other. And the entertainment director called us in the office the next day and said, "That y'all are the worst tap dancer we've ever had in Las Vegas in our career." I said, "Well, do you want us to drop it from the act?" So that you just broke the audience up, said, "Leave it." I've had some times. I really enjoyed life. The good Lord has really been good to me.
Hey, I'm out here in Hickman County, Tennessee, and everybody's a big fan of Del Reeves and Minnie Pearl. What are you going to say about them?
I bought a limousine from Del Reeves. He was one of the great impersonators, and had the girl on the big billboard and all that kind of stuff. And I think he used to do a show every year in his hometown, and a charity show, I'm not sure, but I knew Dale real, real well, and I knew Minnie Pearl. Well, we did a show, I only worked one show with her in Chicago, and it was a big package show. It had come a snowstorm, and me and her was the only one got there. The rest was on buses, all big, big lineup of stars, and that's the only time I didn't know her real well. If somebody don't know me and I don't know them well, I don't know them, you know.
Elmer, did you play the Grand Ole Opry quite a bit, or did you ever get to play the Grand Ole Opry?
You know, I could have. It didn't pay, and I was so busy, and I should have, because Durham and I were pretty close friends. In fact, he was up in Wisconsin one time, and he was lost. Hal Durham, he's no longer alive, but he managed the Opry for years, and I knew him. I went out any time I wanted to take people out. I had no problems with that. But I never did ask him, and but he was up in Wisconsin. He was lost way out in the backwoods. And the guy seen his tag from Tennessee. He said, "Hey," he said, "you're from Tennessee." He said, "Yeah, I manage the Grand Ole Opry." He said, "Who's your favorite singer from Nashville?" He said, "Elmer Fudd-Pucker." And Hal liked to drop his teeth. He thought that said, like Dolly Parton or somebody like that, Johnny Cash. That was a story he told around the Opry House. Whether it's true or not, I don't know, but it sure makes for a good story, don't it?
Yes, sir.
Now, I remember the first country show I ever saw, they used to run buses to the schools, and I remember seeing Uncle Dave Macon and his son Doris. I remember that far back, but I never did. I knew the Food Jar Drinkers. I mean, I knew when they was playing the Opry, and I go back a long ways, but I never did meet the Sullivan Old Jerseys. I knew Roy Acuff. In fact, Roy Acuff worked. I need to do a benefit for, I think it was Bill Anderson's drummer got killed or something. And I had a dinner theater in Nashville, a big one, and I asked him if he'd do a benefit because there wasn't enough money to bury Bill's, I believe it's Bill Anderson. I can't remember now. Don't hold me to this. But anyway, he said, man, I don't know. I don't never work, you know. And he cut on the stage and said, I don't remember ever working a saloon before. It was really a dinner theater. It was a pretty nice place, good lighting and sound. But I got him to work for me for nothing, you know. Wow. And he didn't. I thought that was an honor for him to do that for me. And I'd do it for the drummer that got killed.
I would say that it was.
The Grand Ole Opry used to pay $6 a night. For one show, you could do two shows, you got $12 if you did the early show and the late show.
What was it like to try to what would you have to do? Go to audition on the Grand Ole Opry to be able to, you know, get on?
Yeah, he had record. The only one that never had to do that was Stonewall Jackson. He was the only one that got on the Grand Ole Opry. Roy Acuff got him on there. And I got Boxcar Willie on there because I was in Madrid, Spain, and Boxcar Willie backed my show. And he said, you working with George Jones at the Possum Holler when you're in town? I said, yeah, sure. He said, can you book me in there, you think, when I get back to Texas? I said, well, I'm pretty tight down there. In fact, nobody knew it, but I booked all the talent in most of the time, unless George or Shook wanted to book somebody else that beside me. But anyway, I got back. He got out of the Air Force, and I got back there, and I forgot all about it, you know. And his manager called me. A soft drink dealership who put the money up to do all them TV albums for him. But anyway, he called me, his manager, Bill Palmer. I worked just for his club when I come to Texas on a Monday or Tuesday night through the week. He said, you remember you told Boxcar you'd try to get him on in the Possum Holler? I said, yeah, I do remember that. I said, well, I'll send you a contract and we'll book him in here. I can't get him a $500. I had to ask Joe. I said, Chug, I didn't ask George nothing, but I said, Chug, he really owned the club. George just used his name. He got a small percentage. But anyway, I said, I got a friend I owe a favor to, Boxcar Willie. He said, I never heard of him. And said, Buttfuckers, enough gimmick for me. I don't need no more Boxcar Willies. I said, Chug, if you don't like him, I'll pay the $500 myself. He said, well, I can't go wrong on that. Well, that week, we had another tragedy, and everybody I knew was on the show the week Boxcar was there. Had Tammy and George and Roy Clark and just name it. Bill Anderson, just keep on going. I mean, his name's Waylon Jennings. And anyway, Boxcar was booked that week, but he wasn't scheduled. They wasn't going to let him appear on that particular show because I don't know why they played in, but Boxcar cut me and said, man, I love to be on that show. I said, they see me all the time down here. These people, I said, you just take my place and I'll make arrangements. And Roy Clark backed him on guitar. And I don't believe to this day what Boxcar did now, but he didn't remember what he sung. He
really?
Was so nervous. Oh, that's a true story. That was really happened.
And Roy Clark backed him.
And a guy from England saw him, and that's how he really. I didn't start Boxcar Willie. I got credit for it in his book. All I did was open the door. I didn't start it. I just opened the door for him, and he was smart enough. And I told him how to promote it and how to get the management and how to get this and that and the other. And but that's the Boxcar Willie story. If you buy his book, I never have read it, but they say I'm in there and that I did that. I think that's a good story myself, and it's a true story.
About your relationship with James Brown, and for those people that don't know about about his famous cape routine.
James Brown was the only act I worked with that sold out every show. I have never been with him, didn't sell out. there was a guy, we were happened to be working in Nashville, which was unusual for me to work Nashville, because I'd worked it so many times, but I was on the show. And he had a tornado coming through Goodlettsville. It's just outside of Nashville. And one of the radio stations, WATF, one of them said, if there's anybody sights any tornadoes, be sure and call us. Abe Stein got on the phone and said, there's not any tornadoes out here right now. I hadn't spotted any, but I hope no any don't come September 16th when James Brown's in town at the auditorium. Now, that to me is funny. That's good to me. And Wally Fowler did it one time on the opera. He was, you remember Wally Fowler, the gospel singer?
Yeah, I do.
Anyway, he had a bunch of shows in Alabama. He would do it. He would book three auditoriums at once and have the gospel groups go from one auditorium to the all three worked all the auditoriums. And he was on Friday night. He did the gospel something at night after 12 o'clock, and he was doing the benediction. He said, "Oh Lord, let's hope everybody gets to the show safe in Florence, Alabama tomorrow night at whatever city." I said, "Man, that's really come on. That's got to be beat bad."
You probably remember the Leuven brothers, I would assume, pretty good.
I knew them real well. In fact, I regret, Charlie Ira got killed. He was playing an NCO club in Missouri, I forgot, it's an army base, and his wife was driving, he was in the back seat. They went on the interstate the wrong way and killed Ira. And I helped put the talent together for the last package show. I mean, I didn't pay for it, but for the Shriners, that was the last. You remember package shows? We used to have 15 acts on the show one time. Well, maybe not. I don't have any. We had a lot of acts on there. Right. And Charlie said, "You can get me on that show, can't you?" I said, "Man, Charlie, I doubt it now." I said, "I've done got everybody booked." And I said, "I'm not really the agent handling it." I said, "I'm just suggesting who the, somebody, and I will try." But I regretted to this slight day. They had a $1,000 budget that I could have got him, and I didn't know it at the time.
So they ran, she was driving and went up the interstate the wrong way.
That's right. And they just worked an NCO club there. And what's that army base in Missouri that was where Fort Leonard Wood?
Yeah.
They had just worked Fort Leonard Wood. I worked it for a week one time, it was like a month. Because they'd have them guys out in the morning marching at 5 o'clock, and they were trying to come see my show. It wasn't easy. I always regret it because I'll tell you, they were. Them two guys, they helped build the Grand Ole Opry. Them and Roy Acuff and people like that, and Ernest Tubb, they're the ones that made it happen. I don't care about the management and all that other jazz. Them people made the Grand Ole Opry, and the Fruit Jar Drinkers and all them people, Grandpa Jones. And in fact, I got a picture of me and Grandpa Jones. I never took many pictures. I don't know why I didn't. I was sort of, I just didn't want to bother the artist. But Grandpa Jones one night, we was backstage. He said, "We got to get a picture together, Foot Tucker." I said, "Okay, we got to grab a front of Grand Ole Opry signs." And they put it in a magazine, and I got the copy of the magazine. That was a real honor to meet. I mean, I knew him real well.
You probably knew String Bean very well then, I'm assuming.
Yeah, you know, they was right across from each other. Did you ever hear that story about the women come by to get Grandpa Jones with more in his grass? You ever heard that story?
No. Tell me.
Well, anyway, Grandpa, him and String Beans lived, they would go for days not even speak to each other. They loved each other, but they'd sit on their front porch and just look at each other. Now, this is what I was told. I wasn't there, so I could, but this really did happen. Grandpa Jones's place was fenced in, lived way out in the country, and he was mowing the grass, and these two women, or three women, come by and said, "Mister," said, "just bought a place up here. What do you charge to mow the yard?" He said, "This woman lets me sleep with her." It was his wife. Yeah. I don't know whether that's funny to you guys, but it's hilarious to me.
Well, speaking of hilarious, I just found something here. And I want to mention the ingredients in this, and I'm going to see if you can tell me what it is. 2 cans of light beer, 2 cans of Sprite or Slice, 12-ounce frozen lemonade, Adams lemonade, and 12 ounces of vodka. Mix and stir like this. Do you know what that is?
That's a putt putter fiddle. That's one of them. I got a lot of different putt putters. I just whatever you want to mix in it. I really sold a lot of glasses. We did a cruise. Everybody that worked with Elvis and around him, they wanted us to do a cruise, and which we got paid for them cruises. You know, people thought we did them just, but we got paid for them cruises. And I got $500 in an airplane ticket and good lodging. That's what I got. Pre-food, pretty good cruise. But anyway, I got a letter. From when Elvis died, my contract with him was over with. In other words, I didn't have a contract with Elvis Presley. I had a handshake, but that was all I ever needed. I was putting out them Elvis Fizz is what it was called, and it was a drink with his picture. Said Elvis Presley still the king, and this cruise. Line wanted to buy, I forget how many dozen, I mean, it's a big order. I said, man, I just got a cease and desist. I can't do that anymore. Well, he said, we'll backdate the invoice to where we bought them before Elvis died, even, you know. Uh-huh. And I said, well, I don't know. I said, it's a big order. Go ahead, I'll ship them. And, of course, they sold them all on the cruise. The Jordanaires were on there. We were supposed to do a television show, and it was rough waters, and everybody got seasick but me and DJ Fontana, and we never did film it.
So you guys never got sick. Everybody else couldn't do it, huh?
Well, I did those cruises. See, I was pretty used to that. It was bad weather. And the Jordanaires were sick. Everybody was hanging over the side of the – and the guy – next to me vomited in the room, and I mean it was awful. I mean it was a bad scene. And of course we would I got paid. Hey, I was the kind of guy, they called me a WM man, work for money. But I did a lot of free stuff, I'm not kidding you. They used to call me and Jack Green and Billy Walker the benefit kings. If somebody needed a benefit, I'm talking about a Nashville picker or something, with do it for them, you know. And I never did charge. Now I got paid for benefits like the Lions. I got paid the Lions, because you can't travel all over the United States for nothing. You got to get paid, you know. But I give them a deal. It was fair. They made money. Billy Walker was a wonderful Christian man, and I knew him well. He talked me out of leaving Nashville. We were sitting in Tootsie's one day. I said, Billy, I said, I'm not going to be able to make it this time. I said, I've had to go back. I got a day job. I just can't make it. He said, listen, said, you're ahead of your time. Said, stay with it a little bit longer. Said, I had the same thoughts. Said, I wanted to go back to Texas because I was having trouble. You know, that was when he had his first wife, you know.
Yeah.
But anyway, he talked me out of leaving town. I always try to plug him if I get the opportunity on any show I do. But I think he was one of the great singers of our time. He just couldn't, Columbia just didn't put enough money behind him, I don't think.
He's had some awfully super records, and I think they should have done more than what they did. Do you remember a gentleman's name, Big John Trimble, out of Richmond, Virginia, a radio host?
He did, Big John Trimble. In fact, he had, I believe, he won our radio show, wasn't he? Was WWVA, or what station was it up there?
Well, he'd started out, he went down to KWKH down there in Louisiana, and then
Freeport.
Yeah, and then he moved on up to Richmond, Virginia, WRVA.
Richmond?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I worked a show. Big time. In fact, I worked the auditorium at Salem. Is that where it is? That big auditorium, pretty good, 8,200 seats, I think.
It could be. It's been a long time since I've been there, Elmer. But Big John, the guy that got him started in radio, started me in radio. And I used to sit and listen to Big John when I was 16 years old, and he kind of took me under his wing. He's the one that was probably the second person in my life that got me started into radio, and it was through him that I met Billy Walker and Betty. But Big John, I knew, you know, he had that trucker show for so many years, and I knew
years and years and years.
But he was a good man, and of course still alive. I just haven't talked to him for a long time, but I just wanted
to... Is he still
alive?
Tell him I said hello. I mean, really, if you talk to him ever again, tell him because I'm sitting down here, and I'm enjoying the American dream, but I wish some of y'all would come see me so I could show off a little bit. I've really got I got a 22-inch lawnmower that needs using.
Well, you want me to come down and mow your lawn?
It's a push mower, too.
Yeah, but you live on the water.
One thing I am proud of, if I'm proud of anything, a little boy named Danny White had the first case of AIDS that we know of in the United States. He was in Kokomo, Indiana. Mm-hmm. Jimmy D, who was a promoter, asked me, he said, I've done you a lot of shows, and said, this kid got AIDS from a transfusion. Said, will you go up there and try to raise money? Said, the people in the town, everybody's turned their back on him. They don't know AIDS. They think it's something you catch from breathing air or whatever. You know, they didn't know it was caused from what caused AIDS. But anyway, I said, okay, I'll do the show. After the show was over, we had pickets outside. I've never had a picket at my show. We had a picket lined up, man, on the outside of the auditorium. I did it for the sheriff's department. That's the only reason I felt safe about it, you know. I was working for the sheriff, but that was an honor to do that. And, I mean, at that time, I wasn't the most popular guy in town, but I was doing it for a good cause. See, I knew what he had, a blood transfusion.
Mm-hmm. How many people ended up coming?
We had about a half a house, and there were people were scared to come in.
Really?
It would probably seated 2,000 or 3,000. I don't know. Kokomo, Indiana didn't have a big auditorium, but we had a half a house. But that was because of the sheriff department. People, strong arm people. You know what I'm talking about? They said you got to come see this show. You're gonna buy a ticket, or otherwise, you know. I don't say they did that. I'm just saying that's probably what happened, because them people, they were mad, boy, because we were doing a show for this. Danny White, he died not long ago. Danny White, you can look it up. I mean, me doing a show probably didn't make no news. It made bad news, you know.
Right, because he'd be the first person that they didn't understand that disease at the time, so everybody was probably scared to death.
They were scared to death of it, man. I didn't know nothing about it myself, except I knew it was a transfusion what caused it.
Jason, have you got some other stuff that you want to ask? Or Hollis, do you have some other things in your mind that I haven't covered that you want to talk about?
No, you pretty well covered it. This is the second interview I've done since 1996, and I'm very grateful that you take the time to do this, because the entertainment business was a great life for me, and I'm so grateful to the fans out there. Most of them passed on now, but I had a pretty good fan club, and I'm grateful for the truckers. Thank you, truckers, for keeping me off the bread line. But thanks so much. I really mean it, because me and this dog are down here. This dog, I'm getting tired of him giving me this trouble. So y'all come help me control him. He's out of control.
Well, Hollis Champion, I'll tell you, it has been an honor to visit with you here in the past hour or so. And by the way, we're going to come down there and help you control that little dog. But in return, as you promised a little while ago, I'm going to expect some free parking at McDonald's and at Walmart. And maybe we'll go out for a swim on Table Rock and eat a McDonald's hamburger. But it has been a great honor and a pleasure to visit with you. I also want to thank Sissy Tree of 615 Entertainment, with offices in Nashville, Tennessee, and Little Rock, Arkansas. She gave us a big helping hand in getting Hollis Champion, myself, and Jason Rogers together. And I want to thank Jason for his questions, and also for sitting back and being with us as we sat with what I believe is a legend, Elmer Fudpucker. For MusicChartsMagazine.com in Nashville, Tennessee, I'm Big Al Weekly.